Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic. Yeah. It's atomic.
Happy New Year. It's just after midnight on January 1st, 2008. This is Rod Adams coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland, and I thought it was time to bring you a new kind of show. Yesterday I got together with John Wheeler from This Week in Nuclear and Kelly Taylor, a good friend of both of ours, to discuss what we thought the new year would bring to the nuclear industry. Hope you enjoy the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing all right.
I'm doing well, thanks.
So happy Nuke Year to both of you.
You too.
Yay. That's cute, Brad.
I think it's going to be an important year for the nuclear technology in general.
Absolutely.
You know, with a lot of new applications and some new politicians, and things might just be very interesting, if nothing else.
Yeah, like I told you when I first heard that, it's never been a more appropriate year for it.
Yeah, I agree. I'm curious, when you say new politicians, who do you have in mind, Rod, and what do you think they're going to do to help urge the Renaissance along?
I'm not sure that I have anybody in particular in mind. I'm a little disheartened by the fact that it seems right now that it's almost every Republican candidate is in favor, and most of the Democrats are pretty much agnostic to completely opposed.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. That's disheartening. I hear from people who are more engaged in the political scene than I am that some of the leading Democrat Party candidates, when you talk to them privately, they're a little bit more pro-nuclear, or at least are kind of middle of the road. But in public, they're not, because they're appeasing that angle of their constituency.
Yeah, it's kind of frustrating because it almost demonstrates a lack of leadership. In their own personal views, they understand the view and the necessity of nuclear, but they're not willing to convince the public that that really is what's in the best interest environmentally and in the interest of an inexpensive power base.
Yeah, the reason it disheartens me is that politically I think I have a lot more in common with the things that are important to the leaders on the Democratic side.
It's going to be a good year for you.
Well, I don't necessarily know. Some people say you're supposed to get more conservative as you get older, but I get more and more worried about the people who don't have much. And I guess part of it is because my family is, you know, a family of school teachers and social workers and that kind of stuff. And I've also worked a lot with people who don't have benefits. And then I go visit the homes of some of the people that I work with on a professional basis and in Washington and see enormous spare resources, let's say.
Yeah, I sort of understand what you're saying. I've always been conservative from financial viewpoint and this, that, and the other, but it's not so much my family as it is my neighbors and stuff like that. The way things have gone very well for those who have, but the last several years in particular have not been very kind to those who have not. and I'm concerned about my neighbors and stuff like that. I'd like to see somebody be able to provide more assistance to those that need it most.
So how do you think nuclear power could help that?
Nuclear power is very expensive when it comes to initial startup costs, but over the long term, it provides less volatility in fuel prices. And because it's baseload energy generation and it is one of the least expensive baseload energy that you can add to the market, it provides stability in fuel costs, which is almost more important than price. But by the same token, it is one of the lowest price electricity supplies available. And we need some, it's good on a lot of ranges because the stable electric supply cost is good for manufacturing, which is good for big business, which is good for hiring my neighbors that are looking for jobs and work and needs a steady income, need to be able to provide for their families. And it's also good for them as consumers so that they can figure out what their bills are and how to cover them. If the electricity prices go up, there are a lot of people that are left in lurch trying to figure out how to pay for heat in the wintertime.
I agree with everything you just said, Kelly. One thing I would point out is a recent observation I made is that some of the newer coal technology plants on a dollar per kilowatt installed capacity are more expensive than the prices that I've heard quoted for new nuclear plants. You know, Rod,
oh, yeah,
just,
without a doubt.
Yeah, Rod, he wrote that blog post about the Edwardsport coal plant. That's a IGCC. Integrated gasification combined cycle.
You got it right.
Plant. Right.
600, if I was right, 600 megawatts for $2 billion. I think.
Yeah, that's about $3,100 per kilowatt.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and the advantage that they don't have, people would like to compare them to a new nuclear facility, particularly when the expense gets that high, but the advantage they don't have is the low fuel expenses, because a lot of people don't realize that the cost of coal futures has gone up double, triple, and sometimes five times what it was, you know, the stable price 5 years ago.
That's right. It's, you know, that price is probably 50% higher than the installed price of a new nuclear plant, and they don't have the stability of price that you talked about, Kelly. Plus, they're even if you have what they call clean coal, you're still not taking out the CO2.
That's true. You know, I think it's actually we need to start go back and reintroduce ourselves because we started conversing and we never told the listeners. Who is who? We'll get this stuff right. This is Rod Adams, and I'm the editor of Atomic Insights and the host of the Atomic Show on the Podcast Network. I also have a day job.
Thanks, Kelly. You want to go next?
I understand I'm next. My name is Kelly Taylor, and my day job is that I'm a stay-at-home mom, but what qualifies me for this phone call is I do have 21 years of experience employment in the nuclear industry, mostly power station work.
And I'm John Wheeler. I'm the host of This Week in Nuclear podcast, and I've been in the nuclear industry for about 20 plus years. I'll leave it at that.
You don't want to say how old you are, John?
That's okay. I just lose count, so I don't bother adding the single digits afterwards. So.
Yeah. That flies when you're having fun.
That's right.
Yeah, well, just to as a expansion a little bit, I've been studying nuclear power since 1981 and served for 12 years on nuclear-powered submarines, including a tour as chief engineer officer. So it's an interesting technology, and it's one that I think that there's some times where the tide is going to shift. People have had a lot of misconceptions about nuclear power that are becoming overcome by events, let's say. You know, Kelly, you talked about the cost of building a new nuclear plant as being very high. One of the things I like to point out to people is where that cost really goes. Most of that cost goes into salaries, and most of the people that would be employed in the construction of a new nuclear plant would be your neighbors right here.
Well, that's interesting. I haven't seen any analysis on that, but I can't say that that surprises me.
Well, you both have been in the nuclear industry long enough to realize that most of the costs associated with the power plant in general, and the licensing and the engineering and the construction, is associated with salaries. I mean, there's just not that much material there. And whatever material there is things like steel, concrete, and lead.
Well, you know, I'm an operator by training and an engineer by education, but for the last about year and a half or 2 years, I've been doing a lot of work associated with developing the future workforce for the nuclear industry. And one of the things that is really apparent is when you go into some of the communities which are targeted for potential expansion of nuclear power plants, the economic development element of what the plants have to offer is enormous, not just for the community, but for the individuals. You have young people who are looking for careers, and working in the nuclear industry provides opportunities for them that they really can't get anywhere else.
That is so absolutely true. There's nuclear, compared to other forms of construction, involve a lot of education in, you know, standards and reading blueprints and this, that, and the other. And it raises, it's kind of an investment in yourself. But who you are when you come through that process, you have a lot more options for employment and a career when you're done by having gone through that process. And working in nuclear is finances up front, but it's also an investment long term. Gives you a lot more options professionally.
Yeah, one of the things I've often told people is I've never met an unemployed ex-nuke.
You know, and one of the things that I see happening...
You operate reactors for food. People don't hold signs like that.
One of the interesting things, recently, I've had two or three people have contacted me who got out of the business years ago and now are interested in getting back in. Just a couple of weeks ago, I got an email from a listener out in California who says, "Hey, I'm an ex-Navy nuke. I've been out of the nuclear business for 15 years, and... hey, I really think this is going to take off, and I'm interested in getting back involved. How can I do that? Can you give me some ideas?" And so we had a little bit of an email conversation about some of the things he might want to pursue. So I think it's pretty encouraging. A similar note from somebody, an engineer who works in the petrochemical industry in Houston and was interested in getting into the nuclear industry. And so I gave him some pointers on people he should talk to. But I do think that the momentum is building.
I worked with many people inside the nuclear industry who, for example, maybe got out of the Navy as a Navy nuke and said, "I will never work nuclear again." And then they tried working outside nuclear and clamored to get back in, as much for the health and safety standards as anything else. It's like, at least you know what you got when you work in nuclear. I know I'm working for people that look out for my health and my best interests.
Yeah, one of the things, you talked about some of the investments in training. I don't know of any other industry that spends as much time and effort training their people to do things the right way.
Pilots, airline pilots.
Okay, I'll grant you that. But aside from that, and to get into the pilot world is pretty hard.
Yeah, it is.
Actually, I have to take exception to that, because nuclear power plant operators get far, far more training than airline pilots.
I haven't seen a comparison, but yeah. As an operator, they always told us that our training was comparable with airline pilots.
I was an assistant ops manager for about 5 years, and one of the things I was responsible for was the operations pipeline and training schedule. And did an analysis once. If you took an operator in a typical nuclear power plant, and if you assumed that they were going to spend about 15 years in the operations organization, and you looked at the training that it took, they spent about 5 years out of 15 in training.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And I used to have a next-door neighbor who was a Delta Airline pilot, and he got 1 week of simulator training per year.
Oh, my goodness.
As compared to 1 week out of every five or six that a nuclear power plant operator gets. It really is, there's no comparison. I don't know of any other field, other than perhaps the military, where people get as much training.
Yeah, and even in the military, the nukes are exceptional. I've been associated with the Navy's training and education system for the last 4 years, and I got to tell you, I spend an awful lot of time trying to convince other parts of the Navy that they should make the similar kinds of investments that the nukes have always made. I mean, when you have really expensive equipment and really expensive machinery, it doesn't make any sense to short the operator training, because one mistake can, you know, take down a very large investment.
The financial risks are very high, but not just high for the plant. There's a recognition in the nuclear industry that we are beholden of one another's performance.
Yeah, in the nuclear industry and in the training and all, you're very much aware and conscious that the rest of your team depends on you to know your part and perform to your standards so that they can work with you most effectively and efficiently. It's not just yourself that you let down. It's everybody that you're working with.
And one of the things...
peer pressure involved.
Oh, yeah. One of the things I also found, and of course there are some exceptions. I hesitate sometimes when I hear people imply that the only way nuclear can survive if we're all perfect, because we're all humans, and there are some people in the business that don't do as well as others. But the peer pressure and the team effort usually has enough backup so that one person's mistake is not going to do horrible damage to everybody else. And I also hope that we can get to a point where we can realize that an isolated incident and an isolated plant doesn't tar everybody with the same brush.
The nuclear industry has basically put itself at the cutting edge of doing research on human error and how to avoid that and protect against it. And it really frustrates me to hear the anti-nukes take that and use that as a battering ram against this. Look, if it were, it must be dangerous. Look how many protections they have in place. And it's like, how can you beat up people for doing the right thing when they've done the research, they've provided information that other industries can benefit from because they've done everything they can do to make it as safe as possible for everybody, not just for the people that work there. Sure that you have seen the statistics and the studies that say that working in a nuclear power station is safer than working in a financial office environment.
Yeah,
if the insurance industry looks at it.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
It frustrates me too, and I don't. I wish, I agree with you, Rod. I wish we could get to the point where a single event at a single plant is not used as an example of why the entire industry should be shut down. But I just don't see that happening. I guess I'm a pessimist when it comes to that. I don't see us making headway in that regard at all. Yet, when you look at other industries, a gas line explosion someplace that kills two or three people is yesterday's news and is forgot about before it even hits the press. Oil tanker springs a leak in Hawaii and spills in 100,000 gallons of oil into the pristine coral reef area, and it doesn't make any news. And the coal miner accidents. Every year we lose how many coal miners, just the United States alone, and it's far greater in other places of the world.
Yeah, in the U.S. it's somewhere around between a dozen and 50, depending on the year. And in China, though, it's about 5,000.
Right. And so, people don't. Those are risks that the public has come to accept as, hey, those things just happen. It's part of life.
Yeah, isn't that funny? They accept it from everyone else except nuclear. We don't accept any nuclear risks.
Well, I think part of that we've brought on ourselves. We have people in the business that, quite frankly, make an awful lot of money responding to minor events.
Yeah.
And emphasizing it themselves. I mean, and, you know, when it comes to things like Chernobyl, one of the biggest industries that reminded people constantly about the fact that a reactor blew up in the Ukraine was Western nuclear power plant vendors who wanted to shut down the PBMRs and build new ones.
One of the joys of podcasting, if you make a mistake, you can go back and insert a correction. I meant to say RBMKs. I like PBMRs. RBMKs are the water-cooled graphite-moderated reactors like Chernobyl. PBMRs are pebble-bed modular reactors. Now, back to the show.
Or do the replacement work. You know,
that's an interesting perspective. There's another odd thing about risk, too. People will generally accept risk very, very easily, and they'll accept very big risks very easily if they feel like they have a choice in the matter. So if you tell somebody how much risk they have driving on a daily basis as opposed to walking or riding a bicycle, that's something they choose for themselves, so they won't be upset or frustrated about it. If you tell them what the cancer risks are from smoking, but it's something that they can choose on a daily basis, that's fine. But if you tell them that there is a very, very small risk of financial loss due to an industrial facility that's in their neighborhood, they feel like they don't have any choice in that matter. And because they don't get to choose that, then they protest and get very distressed over what the risks are that are involved because they didn't get some say in the matter.
Well, that's true. But, you know, that there have been incidents in the last 2 to 3 years where commercial aircraft have killed a number of people on the ground who had nothing to do with commercial flight. You know, people driving on the highway or sitting in an office building or something, and, you know, airplane falls out of the sky on their head, yet you don't see a bunch of people lined up to shut down 8 commercial aviation.
No, you don't. And for the people that are lined up to shut down nuclear because of its radiation risk, they're not lining up to shut down other industries that have a far greater radiation risk or release to the environment either.
That's true. I think one of the things that's going to be an interesting thing to happen over the next couple of years is trying to get involved in conversations with people who really are very, very concerned about global climate change and still cling to the idea that we can solve that problem without allowing nuclear as a tool.
I don't see any way to get there.
No, and frankly, I'm a little disheartened at the whole concept of reducing CO2 emissions with China and India and the rest of the developing nations of the world. The people there are clamoring for energy. They need energy to raise their standard of living. And they're going to choose whatever the lowest cost option is. And if that happens to be burning down the rainforest, then they're going to burn down the rainforest. If it's burning the dirtiest coal they can get their hands on, that's what they're going to do. It's really up to the developed nations of the world to figure out a way to help them make wise choices. And when it comes to nuclear, I think some creative financing, some out-of-the-box thinking on how to build plants, perhaps smaller reactors. I know, I thought I'd get a chuckle
that's
out of you.
That's not such a bad idea.
I think it's a great idea.
But, you know, if you can modularize the construction and then ship the units where they can be used and provide turnkey services to operate and maintain them, then you can make them a lot more cost-effective.
Exactly. And by the time you get to the largest reactors, you're limited to possibly only one supplier for the largest forgings, maybe two. But if you could get modular reactors and make them much smaller, you increase the supply in you know, raw materials and construction products. You've increased your options that way.
Okay, here's a disclaimer. I haven't paid either one of those people to say that.
Well, here, I'll make a prediction. I think that in 2008 may be the first year that we see a modern small reactor vendor apply for probably not a construction operating license, but perhaps a design certification with the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
I think that you probably have it right.
Yeah. Wow. That'll be interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that, if you look at the cost of energy, I don't see how one could look at what is possible and say that nuclear can't be absolutely the cheapest form, because it's so much easier once you get things together. And easier meaning with coal, unless your plant is right on top of the mine, you have to move the coal a long way. You have to grind it up.
You're paying to ship a mountain.
Right.
Transportation costs are huge.
I was just reading a really neat brochure that's on the site for a public power company in Kansas. And they operate about 1,000-megawatt plant that supplies half a dozen cooperatives. That plant burns coal from Wyoming, and the cost of the coal is one half of the cost of transporting the coal to the plant.
Yeah, I believe it. King Coal is what has kept our railroads in such good condition. Seriously, that's where the money comes from for upkeep for the railroad lines. It comes from all the coal cars that travel all over them.
That's true.
If we could just transfer the coal shipping railroads into light passenger rail, and convert it to electricity, we'd be in great shape, right?
Or high speed rail, which definitely would be electricity. That would be a much better way to go.
Unfortunately,
the car pollution. There's another way that nuclear could improve the environment. If we could convert the high-speed rail and make it electric, then we could have nuclear-powered trains.
Like France does.
And cut down on how many cars and stuff we have on the road. That's just un-American.
Well, you know, I'm all for you there, but, you know, at the interim, we need to figure out a way to transfer the transportation fuel source away from petroleum towards electricity. And one of the developments of the coming year that I'm looking forward to is, and I have not confirmed this, but I've heard that the hybrids that Toyota produces are going to be plug-in hybrids in 2008.
I've heard that also.
So being able to shift some of the transportation energy source to the grid away from the gas pump, I think it's a very positive development.
That would be excellent.
Well, it is a positive development as long as we definitely push towards getting that grid a cleaner grid. Right now, we still have way too many grandfathered coal-fired power plants operating. About 50% of electricity comes from coal, and many of those plants were built before 1970, so they haven't had to do all of the improvements that the Clean Air Act requires.
And nobody wants to upgrade the grid. Nobody, nobody, nobody. Everybody wants the power when they turn on the light switch, but they don't want to see more towers in their neighborhood.
They're ugly.
Okay. I'm not worried about it when I'm indoors and warm.
Well,
yeah, but I like to hike around the clean and pristine mountains in the Appalachians, and of course all the scars from power grids is now getting added to by having windmills up there. So,
well, we've come in this country, you know, we're very fortunate that we have an infrastructure that supports virtually 100% reliability of the electrical system. It's probably 99.999.
Right.
I lived in a country where that wasn't the case for 5 years, and where when you turned on the light switch, you didn't automatically expect that it would come on. You kind of wondered whether it would come on. So
it's a lottery.
So, you know, we may get to that point in this country, certainly in parts of this country, before the public demands that we take action and is willing to pay for it.
Well, you know, one of the things that is interesting about the small plants, for those of you who don't know, I am an advocate of small nuclear power plants. And over the last probably 2 years, Adams Atomic Engines has received a number of inquiries from places in the United States that are already in that situation you just described, John. Places in Alaska, Hawaii, some of our islands, protectorates like Guam and Saipan and a few others already don't have a reliable grid. And if they do have power, it costs starting at about 25 cents a kilowatt hour and going up from there.
Yeah, because most of those places are forced to use oil as the source of electricity.
Right. They have big diesel engines is what they run to produce their electricity.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's expensive and not clean air friendly.
No. I mean, you can live in a small village in Alaska where the air should be very clean and have soot problems and have asthma-related illnesses from your children because of the way the temperature inversion makes the smoke hang in your little village area.
You know, in Hawaii, a place that everybody associates with beautiful, pristine, natural environment, generates 100% of their electricity with oil. And the cost of that, shipping that oil to Hawaii out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, is astronomical.
John, do you know what kind of oil they burn?
I don't know.
Do they burn nice distillate fuel, or do they burn the nasty residual oil that used to be used in power plants?
I'd have to do some research. I don't know that. I just don't know. But I'm pretty confident. I was talking to somebody just recently about that, and I can't recall who it was. But 100% of the oil, or 100% of the electricity in Hawaii, is generated from oil.
Yeah, based on my calculations, if you're burning oil today for electricity, the fuel cost alone is about 25 cents a kilowatt hour.
I'm going to Google it right now, see if I can find out.
Okay. I hear somebody banging around in the background. That must be you, John, your keyboard noises.
No, it could be me. I saw an article recently, and I'm failing to come up with it, about a Japanese company, I think, who was trying to do research to basically provide modular power supplies for apartment complexes that were nuclear in nature that had like a 40-year lifespan or something like that.
Okay.
It was relatively maintenance-free for an apartment complex for 40 years.
I can give you a little background on that particular web hoax. Toshiba does have a development for a smaller nuclear plant called the 4S, which is 10 megawatts electric.
And that's the one that they were looking to put in for the one town in Alaska that was considering being their pilot.
Galena, Alaska.
Right.
The Japanese have a development for a development arm of the Japanese government called CREPI, which has done some work on a lunar power supply that has a power generation capacity of about 200 kilowatts. Recently, there's been a web story floating around that combined those two projects, the characteristics of those two projects, put together a picture of the 4S and made it look like a logo from Toshiba, and then posted the story saying that Toshiba was producing these reactors. I've actually contacted Regis Matsey from Westinghouse, who's also owned by Toshiba, and Regis is their advanced power guy, and he contacted Toshiba directly And I got word from the Toshiba public information system that they have no idea who's putting this story out. It has no basis in fact. Their smallest development process is the 10 megawatt electric 4S, which is stands for super small, safe, and secure. And they believe that that's about as small as they'd ever want to go for a commercial application. So that says 10 megawatts is 50 times bigger than a 200 kilowatts.
Well, thank you for that.
No problem. I know that because I'm starting to write a blog post on it. I just haven't got around to it yet.
I was going to say, you could start your own, you know, nuclear brand of rumor control.
Well, I hope to get people taking a look at Atomic Insights. I really want to make that a reliable source of information, although I always acknowledge that I do have my own biases towards smaller nuclear plants. I have no problem with the big ones. I just think that their market is limited, and the suppliers, like you said, Kelly, are limited. So there's going to be a backup pretty quickly in the large nuclear power market. There's a lot of queues already developing for those pressure vessels you mentioned.
Well,
John,
thanks to the thanks to Google, I was able to answer our Hawaii oil question. It says that found a document that indicates that Hawaii generally burns residual low sulfur fuel oil that is left over after lighter petroleum products are refined. So they're burning kind of the bad stuff, and that it's either imported.
Well, it's low sulfur diesel.
Yeah, it's either imported by tanker into Hawaii, or it's brought in as crude oil and refined in Hawaii. Interesting, 7% of the oil that is consumed in Hawaii is consumed getting it there by marine transportation.
So. Interesting. Well, speaking of marine transportation, that is one of my other predictions, is that the marine transportation market will be looking quite heavily at nuclear propulsion for a couple of key transportation needs, like long-distance, high-speed container ships. And I think the Navy's going to go back to maybe building some nuclear ships besides just the aircraft carriers and submarines.
Yeah, I saw a report not too long ago that the Navy had completed a cost-benefit analysis and had made it and had decided, based on cost-benefit, that they were going to increase the number of nuclear-powered ships in the fleet and move away from fossil fuels. But what I wasn't sure about is at what size of ship were they referring to?
The study said anything on the cruiser-sized ship, about 20,000 tons or greater, and large amphibious ships. It's surprising that all of our aircraft carriers are nuclear or will be shortly when we finish retiring the Kitty Hawk, but we still have a bunch of large-deck amphibious ships to carry Marines and helicopters around. They're all oil-powered. And the cost-benefit analysis was done. And then Congress, in the Defense Authorization Act of 2008, included language saying that since the cost is basically a wash, the tactical advantages of nuclear and the strategic advantages of not having to buy fuel from unstable countries is makes it smart to build nuclear-powered ships again.
Well, that's a positive thing, because when we used to have a large number of nuclear ships, we also had a large number of ex-Navy nukes who were looking for employment in the commercial nuclear industry. And that source of manpower is really kind of dried up. I wouldn't say it's dried up, but it's greatly reduced compared to what it was maybe 15 years ago.
Well, you're going to have to convince the Navy to start training a few extra nukes, too.
Yeah, we definitely need more nuclear people if we're going to start building more nuclear reactors.
Of course, that's a wonderful challenge. I mean, the country as a whole has plenty of people, and plenty of people who are smart, talented, want to pay attention to quality control, and many of them are looking for work. So I think that the match is pretty good. And we got plenty of people here in the U.S. that can teach as well. We've got the seed corn ready to go.
Well, I spent the first 5 years of my career working at a Navy prototype. I was a civilian, but I was a civilian Navy nuke, if you will. And we trained, just on my crew alone, I once figured out about 250 Navy nukes went through our crew in 5 years. And there were five crews at that prototype. So the number of people that the Navy was training in the mid-80s was very, very high.
And at that time, there was...
The trick to that is almost the finances. The Navy was training the people for their own uses and stuff. The electric industry trains their people to produce power. And it's difficult to free up the forward-looking dollars that say 3 years from now we're going to need a trained workforce of X amount of size. Who's going to invest in training those people? It's tough to free up the forward-looking dollars when you're spending money on day-to-day ops.
Yeah. Most of the utilities now, that's kind of what I've been working on for my the company that I work for, and most of the utilities now have broken that loose and have begun to invest long-term because they're doing studies 5, 7, and 10 years out in identifying a need. And it's already starting to be a critical need in some utilities. Talent for operators and people who have experience training operators, the need is very high right now.
Right, exactly. And what I have seen is utilities that have done the studies and said, oh, yeah, we have this critical need like 5 years ago. Why weren't we already doing this? So instead, the shift is how do we make use of the people that we already have? And they're basically looking at delaying retirements, looking at people working flex time after they retire. They can work up to 1,000 hours a year without losing their retirement benefits or the company taking any financial hits. But they're basically trying to keep people at the other end until they can bridge that gap and get new people trained up and to full functionality, if you will.
Well, one of the things that I think is going to happen is that many of the people who are close to that retirement age and the industry's worried about losing, particularly in the vendor community, the engineers that design stuff, I think they're going to get excited, and many of them are going to extend their careers simply to be involved in the actual construction and bringing online of new plants.
Who wouldn't?
I mean, I got a good friend who works for Fluor, Bob Brohm, and Bob's been in the industry for a very long time. He was a very young engineer when his company built Palo Verde, and he's now the lead mechanical engineer for a new construction for NRG. And Bob's, you know, getting close to retirement age, but he's saying, this is really cool. Finally, I'm doing what I was trained to do.
Well, you know, I spent most of my career in an industry that was collapsing, shrinking, whatever you want to, you know, it was going away, and it was a struggle at times. At a couple of the plants that I worked at, I had the fortune, if you will, to work at a couple of plants that were designated troubled plants, and was involved in the turnaround of getting those plants up and running and performing well. But there were times when week in and week out, we weren't sure whether the company's board of directors was going to pull the plug or not and shut the plant down. So having lived through that and seeing the effect on the industry of that period of time, it is really exciting now to be in an industry where there's a lot of growth opportunity. a lot of optimism. It's fun.
I had a friend that had a standard nuclear supervision job probably, 7-8 years ago, when an opportunity came up in the company that he was working in that involved basically a step down from where his title was. He was going to be a worker bee and work in licensing, and he jumped at the chance because his company took a very dim view of it at the time. It's like, why are you stepping down from being a supervisor? And he was moving from being a conventional nuclear supervisor to this upstart little group that only had 3 or 4 people in it that was looking at licensing of a new reactor. And he's like, oh, yeah, man, this is like the best job in the company. I'll take it in a heartbeat. Well, the company was just taking advantage of government incentives that were available. They weren't really serious about building. And they didn't really think that building would be something that would become serious at that time. But he took the job, and it's worked out really well for him because it's looking like that company will end up building now 7 or 8 years later. And he's like, oh, yeah, I still have the best job in the company because he took a risk when the opportunity was there, and he has so enjoyed the work that he has done in the meantime. It's been really exciting for him.
That's a great story. I'm hoping that there are plenty of people like that in the nuclear business, and I think there are. I've met a lot of them over the years, and I think it's so cool. That's why I suggested we get together and talk about this happy nuclear stuff. It is exciting. We can't quite challenge the twits yet.
Well, we need some practice, Rod.
Oh, yeah. Well, the twits did, too, if you ever listen to their first episodes.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's a lot more fun to do it with a few people than just to do it alone. So let's hope we get together and do this on a regular basis.
Well, cool. I don't know about you, John, but I think it's easier, too. I'm a lazy kind of guy to begin with. It's so much easier to just chat with friends and record that and hope that people find it interesting.
I'm expecting you to say that, Rod. As busy as I see you all the time, it's hard to imagine you saying you're a lazy guy.
Yeah, I get emails from you at 4 in the morning or 3 in the morning. I'm wondering, when does Rod sleep?
Well, I have a day job and a night job.
Yeah,
as a matter of fact, I've got another conversation scheduled this morning. I'll be talking with a guy about one of my favorite anti-nukes, Amory Lovins.
Oh, that'll be fun. Is that going to be posted before too long? I can't wait to hear that.
Yeah, it's an interview with a guy or a discussion with a guy who also has written a number of very critical pieces about Lovins and his lack of ability to handle real numbers. This guy's the editor-in-chief of the Energy Tribune named Robert Bryce. And so I'm looking forward to the conversation. He's also been interviewed several times recently about ethanol, and his description of ethanol is a scam.
Hmm.
Well, when you talk about funny math, it just drives me crazy that the anti-nuclear radical environmentalists continue to get away with their claims that we're going to make global warming go away with solar and wind and conservation. Why the press allows them to get away with it, I have no idea. Simple back of the napkin math will tell you that just won't work.
In 2005, I read a report that was put out by E.ON, which is the German company that is one of the world's foremost leaders in supplying wind energy to the grid. And their report in 2005 talked about how unstable their grid was, that they would basically export power to Denmark and they were disrupting other surrounding grids because when the wind was there, it was all there at once, and when it wasn't, the difference between having lots of wind power and having no wind power at all might be 2 or 3 days. That it was that unpredictable that they had no way to know when it would be on the grid and when it wouldn't. And so they had to have 100% replacement capability through standard fuel sources for when it wasn't there. So they had already invested in all the infrastructure in the Standard Energy in order to get the benefits of the wind energy when it was available. And when it was available, it caused problems with keeping the grid stable because they had no way to store the extra power.
Yeah, so, yeah. So not only do you need 1,000 megawatts of wind, of course, there's no such plant in the world that fits that big. So let me back
right.
it down. You need 100 megawatts of wind, but then you also need 100 megawatts of replacement power. So
exactly.
you really need 200 megawatts of capacity in order to get 100 megawatts of wind power.
And
right.
in the meantime, that 100 megawatts of replacement power that you're hoping not to use is going to be whatever's the cheapest that you can put in quickly. So it's probably not going to be that environmentally friendly because you're going to take credit for the wind as offset. So instead of combined cycle natural gas, you might just do the once-through natural gas plant and not worry about the waste. It's actually less efficient in many instances.
Yeah, it's probably gas.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And the other thing about the wind is you put the wind turbines where the wind is, and you have to build the transmission facilities from the wind to the people. With, you know, thermal plants, you put the plant near the people and build less transmission. With nuclear plants, of course, you can put the plants right next to the people since they're quiet, clean, and safe.
And the people just love them. Unless they happen to live, like, more than 30 miles away and then they hate them. I don't understand. But when you live in a community with them, you know what kind of good neighbors they are. And the plant that I no longer work at, it was really exciting. As I was leaving, we had second-generation employees at the power station. And, you know, you don't send your kids to work in an environment that you know is dangerous. If the people that worked there at the power station knew that it was a health problem, then they would train their kids to work somewhere else.
Right.
You know, that's the ultimate investment. That's how you know that you got something good going. It's like, yeah, I'd be happy to have my kids work in nuclear.
Yeah, it's funny because that you say that the folks who are in the area typically like living next to nuclear plants. One of the, and I laugh because one of the most outspoken anti-nuclear activists that lives near the Indian Point plant moved there from Ohio. And so he moved into the community, probably 3 miles from the nuclear plant, and then became a nuclear plant opponent. I said, well, gee, if you knew the plant was there, why'd you choose to live there?
Well, because the air's cleaner than it is in Ohio.
It probably is.
Now, if we could just shut down this nuke plant and replace it with coal, then it'd be perfect.
It'd be just like Ohio.
Exactly.
Well, he's one of the supporters of Congressman John Hall, who wants to turn Indian Point Energy Center into a renewable energy center with tidal power, wind power, and solar energy. And downstate New York is such a great place for wind and solar. So.
Yeah, I had friends that went to school on the Hudson River. They tell me how great it is most of the year. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm here now, and I'm in New York State today, and it actually, we have blue skies, but that's because a front went through last night and dumped 3 inches of snow on us, and now it's headed out over the Atlantic, and it's pretty.
You got snow. We got rain.
Yeah.
So the question is, John, who would shovel the snow off of the solar panels?
That's a good question. You'd have to have electric heating coils powered from nuclear plants to de-ice the solar panels.
Oh, well.
Anyway.
Well, it's going to be a great year and hopefully just the start of something really big because it's going to take an awful long time for us to recover from 30 years worth of not building plants. But I think we can do it. We built the plants that now produce 20% of our electricity in just 20 years, so when it comes right down to it.
Well, you know, I did some, I was working on another show and putting some notes together and figured out that if we were to build large station, central station generators, if we just doubled the number of nuclear plants that we have today and did the same thing that we did in the last construction era, then we could increase the percentage of electricity generated by nuclear to about 40%.
Okay.
And still account and basically keep the number of coal plants stable.
Are you sure? I didn't think that would work because of the growth in the electric grid and the infrastructure.
Yeah, I just did some quick math, and I figured that right now we're generating 20% of our electricity with nuclear plants, and we have 104 plants, but a lot of those plants are relatively small, you know, 600 to 800 megawatt range. And the new plants would most likely all be in the anywhere from 1,200 to 1,600.
Larger. That's why that works.
And so that's why it works.
Yeah, the smallest plant that's being talked about for construction right now is the AP1000, which is really about 1,150 megawatts. The ESBWR is bigger than that. The EPR is about 1,600 megawatts, and the Mitsubishi plant's about 1,700.
Yeah, I'm thinking the ESBWR is about 1,400 to 1,500 in that range.
Yep. All right. Well, you guys have a great day. I'm going to think we're going to close out now because I find if we go too much more than about 50 or 55 minutes, I get tired, and I'm sure the listeners get tired. So,
get some coffee, Dad.
Well, I have been up since about 2, so.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
All right. Listen, both of you have a great New Year's Eve, and a wonderful 2008. And I look forward to talking to you both again soon.
Yeah, and we'll have to talk about a scheduled time. And we'll get this on a regular basis because this is fun.
Yeah.
And there's going to be lots to talk about.
Okay.
All right. You guys have a great day.
Bye.
Bye.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need. Something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.